The following is a ministry of the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals, proclaiming biblical doctrine for a reformed awakening. To learn more, call toll-free 1-800-488-1888 or visit alliancenet.org.
It is a pleasure for me to be with you, dear folks, to speak with you about a very important subject, the pre-conference, which is my responsibility to oversee, as you notice, has the term cosmology twice in the titles. And I believe that is the place where we finally, as Christians, must arrive as we seek to make sense of what's happening in the culture at various levels, that we have a biblical revelation that gives to us an overarching view of the way things should be, and that we need to use that to bring sense to the present situation. I take as an example of what is happening what happened on July 26, 2015 at the Supreme Court, where, of course, same-sex marriage was declared to be constitutional. Justice Kennedy justified the majority vote in this way: some rights are too important to leave up to the democratic process. That tells you the nature of the authority that those Supreme Court justices believe they have. Because what kind of truth, then, is available to them to establish the way we organize ourselves beyond the political process? And if it's not the vox populi, it must be the vox dei. But which deus is involved? Well, I would suggest to you that this is indeed not a political issue at the end of the day, as Kennedy rightly, without realizing it, perhaps understands. It is a deeply religious perspective. To get some perspective on what happened on that day, I looked at a text, a 2,000-year-old text of Rabbinic Judaism, not Christianity as such, but Rabbinic Judaism at the time of Jesus. And it was commenting on the meaning of Leviticus 18:20, a man shall not lie with a man. And the rabbis, of course, knew that for thousands of years that had been practiced in Israel. But this is what they understood it to say: you shall not walk in there, that is the Egyptian and Canaanite statutes. And what did they do? A man married a man and a woman married a woman. Those rabbis then understood that the decision to raise marriage to that level of homosexuality was actually a fundamentally pagan process. And so that's precisely where I want to situate where that decision of the Supreme Court actually symbolically places us. For the first time in Western history, the Judeo-Christian moral teaching that has been in place in the West for 1,700 years was overturned. And we were given a redefinition of our civilization's primordial institution, namely marriage. But even beyond marriage now, this definition leaks into the very notion of anthropology. That is, who is man? What is he? What should he do? And from now on, I think we will see unleashed an incredible conflict to redefine who we are as human beings based on this seemingly very narrow choice concerning marriage. Because, of course, everything we do is tied up with everything else, what philosophers call a Weltanschauung, that is, a worldview. And to be fully human means that we must know how to address the big questions, the ultimate concerns. I prefer the term cosmology, and maybe that speaks more to you, because that's made up of two Greek words, logos and cosmos. It's a word about the entire cosmos. And I believe if we don't speak about sexuality in these terms, we will not be doing justice to the full implications of what this new day means. It's very easy, is it not, to be distracted by personal issues of human suffering and difficulties that folks face, especially homosexuals. And I think the church very quickly, and in a certain sense you can understand, gets immediately involved in pastoral issues. How do we envelop these people that have been pushed to the margins and include them? And there are obviously various ways you can include them. There are some who believe we should include them as just regular believers who can do everything else, including church office. That presently is a movement called gay Christianity. I put gay Christianity in quotes. Incidentally, in this book, I don't know on what page, but we have mentioned, and I'll try, oh yeah, on page 24, my little group, Truth Exchange, is organizing a conference specifically on the question of, quote, gay Christianity, unquote, with the title, A Biblical Response to Gay Christianity. I believe that this is the next massive heresy coming down the pike to engage the churches, and I would invite you to come and reflect with us. It will be in Escondido, October 7th through 9th. And I do heartily encourage you to come and to bring others with you. This is, I think, the fundamental discussion for the church in the 21st century. But certainly we are facing this issue, and one of the temptations, as I say, is to deal with the immediate personal concerns of these people and to try to imagine the pastoral approaches that we just must take. And there may be a great number of difficulties that we discover. Because we thus, if we are carried away with that personal concern, perhaps we'll fail to see the cosmological issues that are really present. Because my conviction is that the homosexual movement is the tip of the spear of a massive new redefinition of what it means to be a human being. Melanie Phillips, a Jewish philosopher in Great Britain, speaks of the real agenda of what she calls the attack on Western civilization. And the real agenda is the battering ram against the fundamental tenets of Western culture through sexuality in order to bring a new type of society altogether. This is a great temptation. I'm presently reading a book on the history of the homosexual movement from the 40s of the last century. And there it is clear it begins off in a very small way with one or two people like Harry Hay, I forget his name, in the 40s and the 50s and so on. And it begins to organize itself by claiming personal rights of a private nature. And it appeals, of course, to the Supreme Court's ability to discover in the penumbra of the Constitution the right to privacy. So the homosexual movement did not seem that intimidating at the time if it was only demanding the right to privacy. But unfortunately, this clearly has not been the case. And I will look at that in a minute. But I do want to point out then that you cannot simply push this off as a private issue. And we now know that it is no longer a private issue. It affects the way our children use bathrooms, as we've already said. So I want to bring you to think with me about the issues of sexuality and cosmology. This morning, I'll be dealing with the cosmology behind homosexuality in the first lecture, and then cosmology behind heterosexuality from a biblical perspective in the second lecture. And then tomorrow, in my plenary session, I've been asked to speak on the subject of sacramentalism and sex, and I'll be trying to put those two together. But I do believe that there are ultimately only two cosmologies. Somebody came up to me this morning and said, "I've watched your video, Only Two Religions," he said, "unfortunately, 100 times. Well, he didn't say unfortunately, but he did so because he was leading a Sunday school class. So he doesn't need to hear my lecture. But that's what I've been saying for some time, that there are only two cosmologies. There are only two ways of thinking. Now, that might sound very simplistic, oversimplistic, but I want to try and convince you that sometimes the Bible is very simple, and it's simple for a reason, because our world is very complicated, and if we cannot simplify it, we will be confused. I will try to show you that this is the case biblically, but I want you to know that I'm not the only one to say this, that there are only two possible cosmologies. I would like to cite a statement by Colin Gunton, considered one of the most important British theologians of the last generation, who said this: "There are probably, ultimately, only two possible answers to the question of origins, and they recur at different places in all ages. Either that the universe is the result of creation by a free personal agency, that's one, or that in some way or another it creates itself. The two answers are not finally compatible." When you think about it, there are no other answers. Either this universe creates itself, or it was created by something else, or someone else. So you have only these two possibilities facing you. Robert Riley, a Roman Catholic scholar, in his book Making Gay Okay, How Rationalizing Homosexual Behavior is Changing Everything, he's critical of the homosexual movement, says this: "There are two fundamental views of reality. One is that things have a nature that is teleological, that is ordered to ends that inhere in their essence. The other is that things are only that which is that what we make them to be." So he sees this opposition between ways of being and the only two possible. Either we have meaning within us or we create meaning. De Tocqueville in the early 19th century said this. Remember the French philosopher who came over to the States and was amazed by the wonderful Christian nature of America. "Not content," he says, "with the discovery that there is nothing in the world but a creation and a creator, that is only two possible ways, man is still embarrassed by this primary division of things. So this was true in the early 19th century, and seeks to expand and simplify his conception by including God and the universe in one great whole. So that's, if you've got two realities, the tendency of human beings is to make them into one. I think Al Gore must have been reading de Tocqueville. That's where he got "all is one." But I think it would be much more useful to read what the Apostle says. The Apostle Paul says in Romans 1:25 the same thing, that there are two realities and only two. And so he describes human beings as either worshiping the creation or worshiping the Creator who is blessed forever. You see, that does give us only two options. The Apostle Paul is saying that there are not 365 different ways to God. There are only two, and one, of course, doesn't get you there. There's worship of nature or worship of the Creator of nature. Now, there may be 1,000 different ways of worshiping nature, but it's basically all the same in its fundamental commitments. And I would say that is true as well of atheism. You can have spiritual, what I call oneism, or you can have atheistic, materialistic oneism, but they are all the same in affirming that there is only one reality. That's why I call what Paul says in worshiping nature oneism, because there is only one kind of reality, and so we are involved in our worship then, in worshiping basically ourselves, because we're part of it. So everything is worshipful if it's ultimate. That's why people hug trees. You laugh at them, but they're being consistent with their view of nature as divine. And for simplicity, I call that oneism. I really should recognize my indebtedness almost every day. I should do this to my wife. In fact, I should do it every day. But I was using the term monism, which is the classic expression in philosophy and theology of this way of looking at things, where everything is one. And she said, well, to make it simple, why don't you just drop off the M? It made a lot of sense. So I call it oneism, but for some of you philosophers, you can add the M if you wish. And so oneism is the worship of nature and everything within nature. And so it means you can worship anything. You can actually be quite spiritual because you can talk about God, as de Tocqueville said. Human beings like to think of one reality and bring God in. That's not the God of the Bible, by the way. Because as Paul says in that second part of the phrase, God is distinct from nature as its maker. So God is distinct from nature as a watchmaker is distinct from a watch. It makes no sense to include the watchmaker in the watch. So that's twoism, you see. That's the other reality that we have to face. Because if God is the creator, he cannot be identified with the creation. He's fundamentally different. Everything else has a beginning. God doesn't, because he's the creator of everything else. So I call that twoism, and it, of course, is the fundamental perspective, the fundamental cosmology of the Bible. I always like to say that the Bible begins with this astounding statement, and you can imagine Moses took this into the ancient pagan world of Egypt, of Canaan, and said this massive statement, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." Be interesting to think what might have been said by other philosophers of the time. In the beginning, the earth created itself. So you have this fundamental conflict at the beginning of the Bible with the pagan nations, that God is the creator of all things. And I like to say that thus, everything else in the Bible from Genesis 1:1 on is mere commentary. It is filling out the implications of what it means to affirm cosmologically all is two. Well, that sounds awfully theoretical and abstract, but I want to now change gear and indicate to you how things are changing in our world today, because this oddly is an interesting time in which to do witness on a cosmological level because of the terminology that's being used. I keep seeing, and I don't know whether you do, but you will from now on, statements in the local press and the television and so on of the importance of denying the binary. Have you ever seen that? Have you ever heard that? For instance, I saw an article by two lesbian academics, "Can we put an end to the gender binary?" The program at Dartmouth that it puts out for new students says, "Dartmouth College seeks to provide a living environment welcoming to all gender identities, one not limited by the traditional gender binary." Oberlin College, founded by two Presbyterian ministers and headed by Charles Finney, now says Oberlin is committed to finding a space that defies the binary in our society. This rejection of the binary, when you think about it, sometimes very limited to the sexual arena, I think can be extended, and that's what I'd like to do a little bit in part of this lecture, extended to the actual rejection of the Bible's cosmology. If you think of it in terms of oneism or twoism, binary means two. And so the rejection of the binary is actually, sometimes maybe without even knowing it, the rejection of a cosmology of two-ness, which is the essence of the Bible's view. Here's an example of how very quickly, once the Supreme Court made that decision in July of last year, one teacher of four-year-olds decided that now it was time to change the debate for her kids. And an article was written in the Huffington Post where she said, "So I worked to create a classroom environment where differing points of view, men marrying men, women marrying women, can be addressed. My goal is for the children to feel confident about articulating their point of view in a safe environment where we can eliminate in conversation non-judgmental behavior and challenge binary thinking." So presumably, and this is what I believe, once you start challenging binary thinking in terms of sexuality, this will have an impact on the way you think about everything. It's not just the privacy in the penumbra of the Constitution now, but it's actually extending this non-binary way of thinking to the whole of existence. And I'll give you some examples of that. And it is quite scary when you realize how far this kind of a re construction of Western thinking can go. But I'd like to give you a few examples of this kind of terminology that we meet in our world today. I have a list of them. Busting the binaries is one. Discovering non-dual reality. Non-dual means not two. The delusion of duality. That's not dualism. That's duality. It's making distinctions. You can find the phrase non-dual spirituality. And that's being used in churches and seminaries to describe a certain kind of spirituality that wants to join us to God in an incorrect manner. Non-dual spirituality. Unitive consciousness, bringing everything into one. Interspirituality means the same thing. Destroying dichotomies. Things that are distinct, we have to get rid of, which brings us to the classic pagan statement that you can see throughout pagan literature, the conjunctio oppositorum, that is to say, the joining of the opposites. This is a programmatic intention on the part of paganistic thinkers throughout the ages of bringing together what is separate that bothers us and we want to get rid of those distinct things. And you have to wonder if, perhaps not necessarily consciously or maybe consciously, that joining of the opposites, what de Tocqueville was describing, is really the desire to join man and God into one. So the joining of the opposites is a classic denial of the binary. I do believe that we are facing a massive deconstruction of the old civilization and the determination to reconstruct our present civilization on the basis of a oneist norm for society. And this has been quite catastrophic. Elizabeth Fox Genovese, a PhD from Harvard, who was a radical feminist in the 60s, later was converted to Roman Catholicism before she died. So she was one of those agitators of the 60s revolution that finally wondered what she'd done, and said this: within a remarkably brief period has occurred a cataclysmic transformation of the very nature of society. A cataclysmic transformation of the very nature of society. And it's not difficult to see to what extent that 60s revolution actually set in motion the things we are now seeing today, sort of finishing off the revolution. I think part of that is the homosexual movement in our time. It began, of course, with feminism, the rejection of any kinds of roles or distinctions. It began as well with racism, eliminating all racial distinctions. It called upon the end of colonialism, and it sought this sort of new world that I can only call egalitarian. That is to say, everybody totally equal, totally on the same level. Things have changed a bit since then, especially in terms of racism, but that was the original view of this program, to bring everything down to the same level. And I'm seeing it today in what I have to call cultural neo-Marxism in various forms on our university campuses. But it is the desire to eliminate all binaries, all distinctions of any kind. And I think we must realize in what kind of a world we are called upon to speak the gospel of tourism. It's going against the massive movements of our society in its both unconscious and conscious desires to reformulate the whole of existence. We've mentioned the bathrooms too many times, but I believe that that is what is behind what's going on. It's not sufficient to talk about this as civil rights as such. It's ridiculous as a civil rights issue. But as a symbol of a cosmology, it is perfect. But the battle, finally, is rude, and it is everywhere around you. You are not able to escape it anymore. Here is a statement, though, to let you know just how rude the battle is, from an advisor to the European Union for 10 or so years now, Jeremy Rifkin, a futurist. And this will give you a sense of the ideology as it comes to play in our world. He says, "We no longer feel ourselves to be guests in someone else's home and therefore obliged to make our behavior conform with a set of pre-existent cosmic rules. It is our creation now. We make the rules. We establish the parameters of reality. We create the world. And because we do, we no longer feel beholden to outside forces. We no longer have to justify our behavior, for we are now the architects of the universe. We are responsible for nothing outside ourselves, for we are the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever." That gets very religious, doesn't it? But very radical. This is the kind of battle in which I believe we are now engaged. I don't know whether you saw that video that came up recently where an intelligent group asked a young man to go on the college campus and interview college students as to their response to what he was saying. And it shook me that here is actually the transformation at the level of the university campus for our future citizens who will control the world. Here is the result of this one-ist kind of thinking. He's a white Anglo-Saxon 5'9 guy, and he asked college students to react to various claims he made in front of them. He asked them if they thought he was Chinese, if he was a woman, if he was 6'5", or whether he was a 7-year-old. And here are the responses he got. "I wouldn't tell you you're wrong." A 5'9 guy, 6'5". "I wouldn't tell you you're wrong. Do we really need a classification for differences? If you feel that way in your heart, that's fine." You see, these young people have been so trained that taken away has been their ability to make distinctions, to make any kinds of judgments. They are scared to do it because of this massive ideology that is being taught. And I think it's part of the result of this one system where you can make no distinctions between right and wrong and true and false. I read another disturbing article in First Things on science, and the article was about how a vast majority of scientists now don't care whether what they say is true or not, so long as they can produce articles and fiddle with the results to fit their theories. We're living in a world that no longer believes in distinctions, and thus those distinctions, of course, of all kinds, namely truth and falsehood, right and wrong, male and female, good and evil, that's the kind of world that is being produced as we deny the binaries, and especially the binary of sexuality. But I want to look, with my time remaining, at three areas that Paul himself identifies in Romans chapter 1 as he's describing to the Christians in gay Rome the kind of thinking that they know is in front of them. And he talks about theology, spirituality, and sexuality. I'll look into that probably this afternoon. But just take those three areas where the denial of the binary is taking place in our time. Obviously, the atheists have already done that, but we have now a sort of a form of Christianity that doesn't want to really identify itself, but it's on the edges of the emergent church movement that is seeking for a much gentler theology. These elements, of course, theology, spirituality, and sexuality, are fundamental elements of a cosmology. And I cite as one example Diane Butler Bass in her book After Christianity. She says, "We need a God defined less in dualistic or binary terms, praying to God as our mother, the nourishing spirit of Mother Earth." See, that's got nothing to do with Genesis 1:1. This is the nourishing spirit of Mother Earth that all the pagans worship, because the goddess was a symbol of nature, of the universe. This is what is being suggested now that we need in our evangelical world. We don't need God as a judge, because we have to eliminate the moral binary, non-dual ethics, for a non-dual psychotherapy. There you go, George. This is a good one for you. Carl Jung said, "We must beware of thinking of good and evil as absolute opposites." Richard Rorty, the postmodernist, said, "No act is right or wrong in itself. Objective morality has gone the way of the cosmic order." So in these areas, God, you see, is now being reduced to Mother Earth. And the absolutes of morality are being rejected. In spirituality, somebody promised you a version of the lectures in Sanskrit. I can't do that, but I will give you a Sanskrit word. I was amazed, since I'd been thinking about the cosmology of oneism and twoism for a number of years, and reading the attack in the West of Indian thinking, the Indian Veda, that a scholar who documents this, Philip Goldberg, actually in his book, American Veda, says that America is now buying into the philosophy, is becoming Hindu, and is buying into the philosophy through its practice of meditation and yoga, the philosophy of Advaita. Advaita is Sanskrit, and it literally means, get this, not to. As I say, this is a good time to do evangelism. Because the Christian faith is the very opposite. All is two. So either all is one and not two, or all is two. But that's the spirituality that we are told we need to discover. I was surprised, for instance, to read on one internet ad about joining with a group in meditation. You know, the group that sits around looking at a point on the wall. And it claimed that it could produce a new kind of human being that could transform our planet. And I thought to myself, that doesn't seem very powerful just to sit around meditating. But here's what they claimed that you get from meditation. This is the spirituality I'm talking about, this non-dual spirituality. Filled with a sense of unlimited potential through direct knowing, which is gnosis, you do not have to play by the old rules. You play by the new rules. I am the whole, a sacred emergence of the divine self. And then they go on to say, by meditation we can become a new species. And the goal of yoga is unitive consciousness. You see what that means? It's all trying to get people to stop thinking in binary ways about the issues of life and coming to a sense of unitive consciousness, that we're all one and we're all divine. The last point, I've got 10 minutes with this one, and it's the point to which the whole conference wants me to get to, and it is the denial of the binary in sexuality. And clearly, this is where we are coming against this worldview in our time in the most obvious way. We're all sexual beings, and it's not surprising then that the spiritual forces in this world will focus on sexuality. Now, I think there are landmines that we must avoid as Christians as we deal with homosexuals. One would be moralism and hatred. I don't think we can afford to show those kinds of attitudes to anybody, even the worst of sinners. Because Christianity is not moralism, Christianity is grace. You know what I mean by moralism, right? That we are better than you and we look down on you as inferior moral beings. We cannot do that. We have to show that we too are sinners, only changed by grace. But another danger is mere sentimentality, which you are seeing in the so-called gay Christian movement, only influenced by experience of other real human beings and sentimentally arguing without any theology that we must include them. So we must avoid moralism, sentimentalism. I think we need to avoid traditionalism. Otherwise, we won't win the next generation. I remember when I was in the 60s as a radical student, one thing I didn't want to hear, let's go back to the 50s. Let's go back to the parents' generation. I don't think that's a good argument. Traditionalism is what it is, but I'm not sure that it's a powerful argument for why we need to find the truth. Nor do I think it's a good idea to simply cite biblical verses that oppose homosexuality. Otherwise, we give just a negative view of what we stand for. I think we can only, this is my opinion, we can only successfully begin to respond to this challenge of the destruction of the gender binary via cosmology. And I say this because I know that it's difficult to call someone who's building a cosmology someone who's bigoted or full of hate. And if there are only two cosmologies, you have to choose between one or the other. So either everyone is full of hate or hate doesn't fit. So I'm suggesting to you that as we seek to speak to this massive issue in our culture today, that a cultural analysis is the one that hopefully will succeed. And the reason why I'm saying this, and of course, you'll have to wait till tomorrow to hear the whole development of it in my talk, Sacramentalism and Sex. But the reason why we must take a cosmological view of sexuality is because it is profoundly religious. Now, many people don't see it this way. Many homosexuals just do what they have always done and now don't feel guilty, but they never think for a moment of the religious and worldview implications of their actions. And of course, we're not here to make them feel guilty about that. We are here to show them and to show ourselves what are the ultimate implications of such a lifestyle. I mentioned Robert Riley, Gay is Okay, a brilliant Roman Catholic thinker who has come to describe the homosexual movement in its politics as a whole attempt to rationalize something that is unthinkable. That's his approach. But then he also argues that it is a new form of Gnosticism. Since, of course, like the Gnostics who did not accept the physical and chose simply the spiritual, that the homosexual movement is denying the evidence of the biological and simply seeking to understand the inner self that you could call spiritual as the only way of understanding truth. I myself, it was probably my best book, but nobody's read it. So we have packages of cases of this stuff in my garage. If anyone wants a free one, see me later. It's a book called Stolen Identity, The Conspiracy to Reinvent Jesus. And it's actually a book that takes the various positions about Jesus that was taken by ancient Gnosticism and what the New Testament does in presenting Jesus. So Jesus on various things like sexuality and other elements. Now, I studied Gnosticism both at Harvard and Princeton, almost completed a doctoral dissertation on Gnosticism until my advisor left, and so I changed my dissertation subject. But I did get deep enough into these texts to pull out phrases like this. The rejection by the Gnostics of the objectivity of the flesh, with phrases like flee maternity, destroy the works of femaleness. In other words, there was a rejection of heterosexuality and androgyny, that is, the joining of male and female, was held up as an ideal. Gospel of Thomas 22, for instance. So you have the rejection of normal heterosexuality in ancient Gnosticism. But what's behind it? Some of you have perhaps studied a little bit of Gnosticism, and you know this, that Gnosticism rejects God the Creator and rejects the Old Testament, makes fun of the Old Testament every time it writes a book. And you wonder why it's so fixated on always commenting the Old Testament, because it's fixated on getting rid of God, the Creator. And here's one famous phrase that I've rarely seen stated in any studies on Gnosticism, where you read in Hypostasis of the Archons 94:8, that the goddess Zoe breathed fire upon Yahweh's face and threw him down into hell. You know, in a less obvious way, I feel our Western culture is doing that to God the Creator, throwing him into hell. I will develop this tomorrow, but the point I was going to make, and I've run out of time, is quite simply that homosexuality is not new with us. You can find it in the Gnostic text, but you can find it, go back to the second millennium BC, and the priests of the goddess Astarte are homosexuals. And you can come all the way through history, and a famous world religion scholar by the name of Mircea Eliade speaks of the pagan world as celebrating what he calls ritual androgyny. That is, a spiritual understanding of the joining of male and female. And that translated into, more than not, the shaman or high priest of pagan cults throughout time and space has been a homosexual. And the reason is that there is a religious element in homosexuality that I will deal with later that we are not seeing, and I think not many in the homosexual movement are seeing, but which will lead us into a radical pagan culture. Thank you very much.
This has been a ministry of the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. The Alliance is a coalition of pastors, scholars, and churchmen who hold to the historic creeds and confessions and who proclaim biblical doctrine in today's church. The Alliance hosts conferences, produces radio and internet broadcasts, and publishes online and in print. We continue only with your support. To give a financial gift or learn more, call toll-free 1-800-488-1888 or visit AllianceNet.org.